10 classes to do all of Genesis. Do the math, 50 chapters, 10 classes. Yes, I hope you wore your running shoes. We're going to be going really, really fast. I am guessing that Genesis is familiar territory. Yes. Kind of react to me. Yes. In fact, it isn't Jude, right? Or 2 Corinthians. Or the Song of Solomon, which we're getting more familiar with these days, but nonetheless. Yeah, this is one of the books we know pretty well. Why is that? Why do we tend to be familiar with Genesis? Well, now that can be explored in some way. So let's talk about, where are you thinking when you say to where people start?
Well, the first words are in the beginning. And I mean, when we talk about the Bible or God or whatever to other people, you know, we first tend to say, well, who is God, or how do you know that there is a God? And so we're immediately drawn to
Genesis.
These kinds of things.
Yeah.
These beginning texts.
Gotcha. Good. Give me some other feedback. Why do we know this book well? Because we have children. Some of us grew up at Kleinwood as children, and guess what we learned about in Bible class? Oh no, it disturbs me that you're singing the song. It would be kind of fun to sing the song, right? And to go back and remember the days of creation, fundamental stuff in children's Bible classes. What else did we learn as children about Genesis? Blood? Wow, like, do you have some data on that, or is that your opinion?
I think I have a little data, but, I mean, go into any Bible bookstore, and you will see more storybooks, more activity books.
On the flood.
There's nothing covered.
Wow, so we teach the kids about when God wipes people out. That's the most remembered story.
No.
I'm interested about that.
What else
do we teach our kids about Genesis? Not Joseph, but give me the four. No. The four people.
Abraham,
Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Yeah, we teach those stories. That's exactly right. So from the times our kids are little, and maybe some of us, if you grew up going to Bible class, you heard stories from Genesis. Interesting, we don't typically work Ezekiel with children or Jude, but we do spend a lot of time in Genesis. Yes?
I was just going to say, Genesis also is really sort of, kind of said this already, but sort of the introduction to God is and what he is doing. And so it's like it's already been pointed out, it's a great place to start. But it's also, if you want to understand sort of how God is acting in general, go take a look at Genesis, because you're going to learn a whole bunch. You're going to learn about how he thinks about things, how he rules his people, how he guides his people, how he takes care of his people. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff there that gets us introduced to who God is.
Big kid stuff too, then.
Right.
There's something there for bigger people. What brings adults to Genesis? Why do we go back and look at it, typically? Creation, evolution. That's why the first two chapters are there, to solve the evolution controversy, right?
No.
Y'all really need to pick up on my sarcasm, or class will be very confusing going forward, right? What else do we grab out of there? Yes?
Yes,
I mean, we're like 5 minutes into class talking about Genesis and no one mentioned the promise, right? That's obviously a huge part that threads through the whole story. And we, even as adults, go back there and regularly work that. Yes? Of course, my wife's getting ahead of me. That's okay. That's okay. It's okay, babe. Still love you. That's all right. But yes, let me refrain, because we're going to come back and say some more about that piece of it in just a second. Yes, Chuck?
Genesis is also...
Yes, we get that part of the story too. It's what begins the story. Yes, sir.
I just kind of piggyback on what you said. Genesis answers the question of why.
So you guys are wonderfully nudging me toward the next question I wanted to pose to you, and that is, if we don't know 2 Corinthians very well, but we do know Genesis well, then why don't we study 2 Corinthians in this class? Why go back to Genesis if from the time we're little children we've been going here? How would you answer that? Because it happened. A lot of big things that happened here. Yes, yes.
I think part of it is that it is an ancient text that was written to people that we don't know about things that we really don't understand. And it takes a lot more effort for us to understand what it's all about.
Okay.
Because you have characters that are larger than life. You have people living hundreds of years. It's confusing. It doesn't match up to anything that we experience.
Okay.
Whereas,
so there's some riddles to be figured out when we go there.
But 2 Corinthians, you know, it was 2,000 years ago, but I think we relate
a little more apprehendable than Genesis?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, I think there's a lot of things going on in the world today that stop and go back and look at.
There's a need to go back to the beginning, Scott.
Foundational.
So that's such a great word. And notice what I'm going to put up there. We think the lightning blew out the other TV. Those who've been in class for me for a while know that the technology in this room hates me. So I apologize for those who are sitting here. You will miss all the school stuff on the screen. Hopefully that will be fixed by next Sunday. Did you hear that, tech guys? I'm talking to you, right? The TV isn't working. Okay, so yes, thank you. I think that one of the really critical reasons we need to keep coming back to Genesis is because it is foundational. And what I mean by that is all the other stuff we're working in the Bible, and by that I mean big picture stuff, terminates here. It's built on what we learn here. And so I want to kick that around for a little while as we get started preparing to jump into the book. In what way would you say Genesis is foundational? How does it lay the groundwork for everything else? Let's talk about that a bit.
If you believe the first four words of the Bible, in the beginning God, you can believe anything else. Like, we tend to take for granted, like as little kids, talking about how we talk about this with little kids and stuff, like, they will just take it. Yes, that donkey talked. Yes, those people lived 700 years, and just accept it for what it's worth. Then as you get older, you're like, but wait, how did that happen?
Yeah.
Did it really? And so if you really, in the beginning, God, you can get through that part, and you just say, yes, I'm going to believe this. Then you get into it, but then you have to stop yourself. No, I really do believe that people live, I am 45, and I am tired, y'all. And, what's happening?
It doesn't get better.
700 years from now, how did those people feel? You start to read it, and you're like, really, how in the world?
So it's funny.
I'm the oldest mom in Josh's middle school class, and these people are having babies at 100. what? So it becomes this thing. The little kids, and we're talking about the little kids, they're just like, sure, it happened, no problem.
It's funny you say that, though, because I always get tickled when people struggle with miracles in the Bible, like the talking donkey. Because to me, that isn't the hard miracle. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a whole lot bigger thing than making a donkey talk, right? So it's always curious to me that.
That's why I feel like when we get to adults, the kids are like, sure, yeah, absolutely it did. Yeah. But as an adult, you're like, but wait a minute.
But listen, if you get the first part.
God exists and doesn't try to explain God exists. I always think that's foundational.
So if you can believe
it was God.
In the beginning, God. Yeah. You believe that.
And I like that you stopped right there, because in the beginning, God.
Okay.
That's what it says.
Okay. Let me come back to my question. Why else would we say Genesis lays the foundation? You want in on that one? Jump in.
Because it ties into what they were just talking about. In the first four or five words of Genesis, we're at a crossroads. You either believe in God or you don't. And so at that crossroads is going to, you're going to take a road in your life that is going to take
one way or the other.
One way or the other. And that's why it's foundational. Either I'm going to choose to go and be part of the world, or I'm going to choose to go be part of God's family. That choice is mine. Once I get on that path, it's really hard to change as you get down that path a little ways on either side of it. And we're seeing that division a lot in our society today.
Fundamental worldviews.
Fundamental.
You know, it's part of the Torah that the Jews read the Gospels first.
Yes. So to get the whole Jesus story, you got to go back and get this beginning piece. Let me throw a couple of things your way. One of the things I like about Genesis is it accounts for the beginning in a reasonable way. You get that? Yeah. So I think that all serious people wrestle with the big questions. We think about things like, okay, all this stuff is around me. Where did it come from? And where did I come from? And I think Genesis posits a reasonable answer to those kinds of questions with, as you said, in the beginning, God. And that gives us a reasonable explanation that there is an all-powerful God who spoke into existence everything that we see around us. Now, of course, the atheists would laugh at that and say that's an absurd fairy tale, to which I would say or respond, and what does the atheist have? By the way, what does the atheist have? So I always like to let atheists speak for themselves. So I've got a little clip to play for you. Richard Dawkins is maybe the most famous atheist on the planet. And someone on YouTube saved this little video of him, and to me it is priceless. But he gives you the atheist answer to where everything came from. So let me let you listen to him. Oh, I got the right one. Good.
Of course it's counterintuitive that you can get something from nothing. Of course common sense doesn't allow you to get something from nothing. That's why it's interesting. It's got to be interesting in order to give rise to the universe at all. Something pretty mysterious had to give rise to the origin of the universe. You can dispute exactly what's meant by nothing, but whatever it is, it's very, very simple. I mean, why is that funny?
Well, I think it's a bit funny to be trying to define nothing.
If you press Professor Krauss, he admits that he's not really talking about nothing. He himself says, and I quote, "By nothing, I don't mean nothing.
Nothing isn't nothing anymore in physics.
Nothing isn't nothing anymore in physics.
There could be literally nothing from which something suddenly springs. And I mean, it is very hard to grasp it, and I certainly can't grasp it."
So, yeah, suddenly the Genesis myth doesn't feel so awkward, does it? And that's probably among the greatest atheistic minds of our generation. And that's their answer. And so one of the things that I think Genesis does is it explains the beginning in a way that does make sense and that is reasonable. Yes, sir?
That clip just makes my brain hurt. I say that because I work in a field where we create products. And I spend a lot of time solving problems around creating products. And God created the universe in 7 days. I don't get that. But I understand the complexity in a tiny little bit of that. But I've yet to see a product that got made out of nothing. That I just showed up at work one day.
And that's his theory.
I really wish that would happen. Yeah. It would make my life so much easier.
But that's current atheistic theory, that out of nothing came something. And then... The best part of the whole video, though, is after the audience laughs at him, he is genuinely confused about why they're laughing. I want y'all to think about that. Those opposing worldviews that are at work. So accounts for the beginning in a reasonable way. Let me give you a second thing that I think Genesis does that's really important. The Bible... Genesis, rather, lays out the plot of the story. You buy that? Like a good book or a good movie, Because let me be clear, if I'm watching a movie for 30 minutes and I still don't know what it's about, it's stupid, always. Okay, it's getting turned off. I need to know what's going on. Like, what's that movie? Is it Inception? Dumbest movie ever. Don't argue, I'm not going down that road. But yeah, watch that thing for 2 hours. Still don't know what that movie was about, okay? So the Bible, unlike that, tells us what the story is going to be. By the way, what is the story? Jesus. It's a battle between good and evil. Other thoughts? Yes?
Free will and love.
Sorry. That's what I wrote down. Not saying the rest of you are wrong. I wrote down the redemption story. It's about how God, through the descendant of Abraham, provides for our salvation. So if it's about, and Jesus is wrapped into that. I'm not minimizing the other answers that were given, but I do want you to think about this. How does Genesis contribute to building that story? If it's the redemption story, how God's going to save us through Jesus, yes.
Some point sure. In their story. And it reminds me all of us do the same.
True.
And that's why the redemption is necessary.
Absolutely. Well, okay. And so what in Genesis presents us with the need for redemption? Yeah. Genesis 3, the sin problem is introduced, which is what the story is about. I want you to mark this down because it'll be important later on. The reason for the story is because of the crisis that was created by their sin in Genesis chapter 3. How else does Genesis build the story for us? It does before that, right? In fact, in the very beginning, when he makes us, I just think that is super important. That's a theme we're actually going to pull through our study, that the authority of God is established in Genesis. Genesis doesn't just tell us how everything began. It also establishes a relationship between us and him. How else does Genesis advance or begin, rather, the salvation story? What else does it do? It begins pointing us to the solution in chapter 12 with the promises to Abraham. Yes, sir. Right. Yes. Correct.
I think there's a small microcosm, if you will, of the bigger picture played out in the destruction of Noah. The introduction of sin with Adam and Eve. Some time passes on. Man goes further and further down.
The spread is also part of the story.
And then God says, "I've had it," and He takes Noah and his family, and He says, "Go build me a boat." And he goes and builds a boat, puts the people in it, and he wipes everything out. It's a small microcosm of really the bigger picture of what's going on.
And it starts unveiling that story for us. Yes. Noah too? So the next point I was going to make, we'll use that as a segue, is in addition to kind of laying out the plot, Genesis also tells us who the main players of the story are going to be, right? So it's kind of like a Hallmark movie. Okay, when you're watching a Hallmark movie, not that I do, but my dad does a lot, and y'all need to cut that part out of the recording. For those of you who love Hallmark movies, you know that the movie begins with a good guy who's supposed to be with a good girl, and then there's always a villain, right? Every Hallmark movie ever, there's a good guy who's supposed to be with this girl, and there's a villain who's messing it up, right? Story of the Bible, right? You with me? It's the story of the Bible. There's a good God who wants a relationship with his people, and a villain who is trying to mess that up. So main character of the Bible story, God. That's who we begin with. And set forth as the creator, which means he is the authority. He's the one with the right to rule, the one to tell us what to do. And he begins doing that as the story opens. He begins ordering nature around and ordering man around when he's created. The other main character is man. What do we learn about man in Genesis? Okay, that's more about God. So there is a love and a desire for relationship with him. That's the whole story. Yeah. Who messed that up? Who messed that up? So there's our villain. We could really have some fun just talking about what we learn about these three characters right here at the beginning. Because you are correct, Susan. We learn about God's love for man. What do we learn about man early on in the book? He bears God's image. As? Yes. Thank you. He is the thing that the primary thing at the beginning of the Genesis story is that he's rebellious. And here God showers man with his love, puts him in this beautiful place, and what does man do?
Yeah. God gave man.
Well, okay, so that backs up to God's authority and the fact that God has a right to say how things are going to be. And what we find is at the instigation of the devil, man kind of thumbs his nose at God and does what he wants to do. And away we go with the story. So listen, by the way, what do we learn about Satan in all of this?
This is a really interesting point. Chapter 1, verse 1, we find out that God is a creator. That's how he's introduced to us. How is Satan introduced to us?
As a snake. As a destroyer.
As a snake. Yeah. No, I mean, or a serpent. He's crawling on the ground, the lowest of low. I find that just really sort of interesting in the text because opposite ends of the spectrum. You want to go with God or do you want to go with this thing down on the ground that's crawling around?
It's interesting if we've spent so much time in Genesis, which we were children, that we are really so bad at recognizing the work of the devil. You ever thought about that? I mean, we really ought to get that this guy's behind it and he's been trying to destroy us from the beginning. But you know, another thing we learn about men as we go through Genesis, sometimes we're not real bright. I know it's kind of harsh, but it's true. Yes, sir.
Well, that kind of begs the question, do we really blame Satan for all of this? I know that he's interjected himself into this, but isn't it Adam and Eve?
Who said free will?
For the free will thing.
Yeah, who said that? That was already said in the class, right? We already introduced the idea of free will into the equation. So what's Satan's part in that? He's the instigator. That's exactly right. That pulls men.
We as humans, we can accept it or not. It's like even now, I mean, even today, we can take path A or path B. Satan is always going to be tempted.
Tugging us one direction or the other. How long has that been going on? Are you with me? This is all this is laid out, folks, in Genesis. This has all been going on for a while. And frankly, we ought to have a sense of that. I've got about a billion hands up. Yes, ma'am.
What I find interesting is Satan realizing he can't use God directly. He already lost that. He uses man as his tool, his instrument.
Yeah, yes. And we are complicit with him. We play along with that. Yes, ma'am.
Well, Satan is. We're not real bright, but he's real good at deceiving. And so part of that is on him.
Yes, it is. But you would think by now we would be wise to it, right? So let me tell you why I wanted to explore some of that with you. And this is the part I think that is really, really for me and you today in the world we live in, really pivotal. And that is that because Genesis is foundational, critics of Christianity have launched a vicious attack against Genesis. In fact, I think I would contend that after the Gospels themselves, the next part of Scripture that gets pounced by the adversary is Genesis. I want you to think about that. What is the world, it's just general culture's view of Genesis? It's fairy tale. Sorry?
It's
almost silly. And what, let's talk about the adversary. What he wants you to believe is you surely must be profoundly backward and dumb if you think a donkey talked, okay? Or that the world came to exist in 6 days, because evolution has clearly been proven a scientific fact over and over again. And so for you to believe differently than that, well, you just must not be very bright, or you're caught up in religious myths. I thought I would give you a little sample of why it's important for us to get that. I have a couple of clips to play for you of that I think demonstrate the culture's attitude toward the book we're about to study. The first one is, again, of my good friend Richard Dawkins. What's that? Oh, no, he is, because we need him to keep talking, because he doesn't say things that are helpful to his cause. But I want you to just watch him take a shot at those of us who believe in the Genesis account. This is a, oop, why did that go there? Here we go. His question was, why would you agree to debate with a creationist?
But I will say this, that I've never actually dared to use the formula that my colleague, Robert May, Lord May, who's one of Britain's most distinguished, he's Australian, most distinguished scientists, he was the government chief scientific advisor for a while and then president of the Royal Society. What he says when he's asked to have a debate with a creationist is, "That would look great on your CV, not so good on mine."
You know what a CV is?
Yes.
A resume. Yeah, I think it's the British version of a resume. So what'd you hear?
That Genesis is fantasy, that it's a made-up story, it's a fairy tale.
And if a scientist believes that...
It's not even worth debating.
Yeah, it's so silly. It's like arguing with someone that babies come from the store, right? Yeah, and by the way, I should have put this video in. There's another video I show this to some kids all the time, of him being asked a question by a creationist posing as a reporter, and she pulled one over on him, asking him a real simple question about evolution. I'll show it to you sometime in class, and there's actually 90 seconds of silence that follows, followed by a request to turn off the tape. And then they turn it back on. He gives an answer. It has nothing to do with the question. Here's the point about that. He knows that people who believe in Genesis aren't dumb. So why would he say something like that?
Because he has no factual argument.
He's making an excuse for why he doesn't.
Let's listen. I'm sorry?
He's creating doubt.
Yes.
That's the whole key to
yes.
conflict in Genesis. Just create a little drop of doubt. The side of us that is curious, that is wondering, that is, we start thinking on it.
Yeah.
And thinking and thinking and overthinking until we end up like that guy.
Well, I think what these guys are trying to do is write a narrative about us, and a narrative that is so accepted that people just dismiss without even listening to what we might have to say. And so I want you to pay attention to what he's doing, okay? Now, I want you to listen to this next clip because it's entirely different, okay? Still attacking Genesis. Pay attention to this. This is actually a clip from a television show, I think back between 2010, 2015 sometime, called The Good Wife. It's a conversation between a mother and daughter. The mother's an atheist and the daughter is a believer. Watch this.
So you really believe all this, Grace? The Tower of Babel, Noah's Ark, everything?
I don't know if it's all historically accurate, but I think it can be true in another way.
What other way?
You know, like poetry, it can still be true even if it's not accurate. Look, if I wanted you to remember that God created everything, I'd probably tell you a story about it happening in 7 days. Like, that doesn't actually mean that it happened in 7 days. It just means that I wanted you to remember that God created everything.
Did you just make all that up?
Yeah, why?
Well, it sounds smart.
Well, thanks for being surprised.
So what'd you hear? Yeah, not as mean as Dawkins.
Believers don't really believe what they say.
Yeah. Or there are other ways to understand Genesis that will make it more palatable to an enlightened culture. Which one do you fear more?
The second one.
Yeah, me too. I think about our high school kids across the hall watching that and how that impacts their thinking about things like this. So I want you to get a sense of how Genesis is under assault. And here's the point I'd like to make about that. When you start messing with Genesis, if we are correct that it is foundational, when you start messing with it, you're not just messing with Genesis, you're messing with the foundation. Okay, you with me? And so now the whole rest of the Bible story begins to crumble. So think about that. You don't get Jesus, who is the seed of woman, Genesis 3, without the Adam and Eve story in Genesis 3 when they sinned in the garden. And you don't get the promise of the blessing, salvation through Jesus without the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12. My point about all this is it's a package deal. You can't throw out Genesis without the rest of it crumbling. You see the point? And even later on, you can't say, oh, I'm not buying Genesis, but I want Jesus. It doesn't work. It all goes together. Matt, you had your hand up.
Along the same lines, if Genesis is just a story, then the resurrection is just a story.
Yes, easily dismissed. So what I would like to do with our time together, we have 50 chapters in 10 classes, right? I'm going to keep reminding you of that. And lots and lots we could do. Jeff was telling me last week, he said, you know, when I teach Genesis, I just teach the first 11 chapters. I thought, I wish someone had recommended that to me about 2 months ago. We planned this. But lots and lots of different things that we could pursue. The main thing that I'd like to emphasize as we go through class is this. The vital connection between Genesis and the rest of the story, okay? So as we work through it, that's the thing that we will try to emphasize, how it's all connected together and how it is absolutely necessary for Genesis to be true in order for the rest of the Bible to be true. So we're going to weave this together as a single tapestry, and hopefully you'll see how vital Genesis is in all of that. So those who are in my Sermon on the Mount class know that I am a lover of structure. I like for the things we're working with, the portions of Scripture we're working with to all fit together nicely. We did a lot of work with that on the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to do some of that with Genesis. I've been trying to give some thought to, okay, how does all this material in the 50 chapters fit together? And so I want to do a few structural things with you just so mentally you can organize this material in your mind. Some of that, yes, you're grabbing your hand out. I can't remember what all I put in there. I put the structure we're going to use in there. I'm going to talk to you about a couple of other things. Now, Jeff told me that he has shared with some of you his two cycles of history that particularly involve Genesis. And so he said this wouldn't be unfamiliar to a lot of you. I want to mention it to you because I think it's an interesting way to interpret the material in Genesis. So Jeff's theory is there are two great cycles to history, most of which happens in the book of Genesis. So you begin in chapter 1 with creation, and then in chapter 2, man in paradise in the garden, right, with God. And then what messes that up? Chapter 3, you have sin that comes on the scene and messes up that relationship. And then beginning in 4, what does the sin do? It spreads and infects everyone and everything until you get to chapter 6, and what's God going to do? Sorry? Because what's coming? Yeah, judgment is coming, but before he does that, he has Noah build the ark, which is going to do what? Save his family from the flood. And when that's done, in chapter 7 and 8, you have the flood come, and the flood does two things. The flood brings judgment and destroys, and then Noah and his family are delivered, okay? And that's cycle number one. And then in chapter 9, you start the cycle over again. So, as a result of the flood, what happens to the earth? You start over. That's exactly right. So, we could say, in a sense, the flood recreates because now it's been completely cleansed, right? You follow me? All right? And Noah finds himself in a paradise. And what happens next? Yes. Then we have a problem with sin that makes a rebound, right? In fact, where does the problem occur? Really? It happens in Noah's garden. It's where the sin begins. And then you're correct. It spreads, culminating with the Tower of Babel rebellion in verse 11. And so God, or chapter 11 rather, God's got to do something about this. And so what does he do in chapter 12? Sorry? In chapter 12, we have God building the Ark of Safety, which is the promise to Abraham that through his family, God would provide salvation and rescue. And then finally, what's the last piece of it? What's coming? What's coming?
Redemption.
And?
Jesus.
Same thing. Judgment and deliverance. Yes. That's what we are currently waiting for. And so we are actually in the very last stage, or the last part of the second cycle. That's the end of the story. When God comes and brings judgment on the wicked, like he did with the flood, and delivers God's people. As you see, most of this is covered in the book of Genesis, covered in the first half of Genesis. So one way to look at the material we have is in terms of these two great cycles. We're just going through the second cycle. In fact, we're right at the very end. God has built the Ark of Safety through Jesus Christ, so we know where we can go to be delivered, and now we're waiting for God to bring his judgment on the wicked in our deliverance. What do you think about that? Does that make sense?
Perfect.
Okay? So that's one way to see the material in Genesis. A second way I would invite you to consider is a key phrase that's actually used in the book over and over again. So if you look in your Bible, look at Genesis 10 and verse 1. Will you look there? We'll just start there. Genesis 10 and verse 1. Here's how the verse opens. Now these are the records of the generations of Shem, right? And now you're scared to death because a genealogy is going to follow, right? All I'm going to do is ask you to look at that first phrase. These are the records of the generations of Shem. Now back up and look at chapter 6. Chapter 6 and verse 9. What does that say?
Records of Noah.
These are the records of the generations of Noah. Okay, so back up and look at chapter 5 and verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. That phrase, in some form, occurs 10 times in the book of Genesis. And so maybe the Holy Spirit's saying, quit worrying about the structure, David. I already provided the structure I wanted you to follow. Maybe I should have led with that. Don't say I put Jeff before the Holy Spirit. That wasn't my intent. But it could be that's the way to divide up the material, and I invite you to consider that as we go through it together. If you look on the handout that I gave you, I'm going to divide the class up basically just using these two main divisions. I'm hitting the button. There it goes. I think that Genesis basically has two pieces. The first piece we'll call primeval history. That's chapters 1 through 11. That is a huge piece of history, 2,000-3,000 or more years. And then the second half is patriarchal history. Notice something about the time. What do you see?
Much shorter period of
time. Yes. So in chapters 1 through 11, we are flying through history, right? Just covering huge chunks of time until you get to chapter 12. And I mean, it's like somebody slamming on the brakes when the light turns yellow. And we slow way, 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 way down. And then we basically do four stories. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Okay? So I thought this would be a good way of dividing up our material. And then as I was prepping that this week, I looked at it and said, wait, that's basically eight pieces and an entry class. That's almost so. I thought the outline for the class finished. So we're going to go back and we're going to look at these pieces. The first half will be way easier reading, right? Because we're covering a whole lot of history in a little bit of time. So next Sunday, we're going to talk about creation. So read the first two chapters and give some thought to that. I believe in the handout, I give you the chapters to read for each segment. And then y'all know every third Sunday this quarter, right? What's happening? Yeah, we're in the auditorium just so we can keep disrupting our momentum in class. So when we come back, I'm going to be out of town, and Matt's going to lead us through a study of 3 through 5. We're going to talk about the sin problem being introduced. And then we'll talk about the flood, really interesting things there, and the problem with the rebound, work in the Tower of Babel, talk about all that. And that'll take us through the first period of history. And then I just want to work through the lives of these four characters. Again, thinking about how all of this ties with the rest of the Bible story. I say four characters, that's being generous with Isaac, right? Because Isaac's story is really Abraham's story about having a kid, really. I mean, all the way through that. We just little tad bit. Giving him three chapters is probably generous. And then we'll talk about Jacob, and we'll talk about Joseph. And again, as we go through that thinking, how do these segments tie to the bigger Bible story? Why is this here, and how is this helping to lay the foundation for everything that follows? Really think that's an important way to read the Old Testament. Let me mention one other thing to you just real quick, because we're almost out of time, and I want to throw this in because I think it's an interesting way to read the book. Who wrote Genesis? If Jesus is honest, Moses wrote Genesis, and you understand that Moses was not present for these events, right? When God said, let there be light, Moses did not hear that, okay? So how did he know that's what happened? God told him that. So the events of Genesis are not being written as they happened. In fact, when would Moses have written Genesis?
Probably
during the Exodus. I don't want to be dogmatic about that, but I'm thinking there were probably like 40 years of good writing time during the Exodus story. So when you read Genesis, think about that. Think about the fact that all of this is being written as the Israelites are making the journey from Egypt to the Promised Land. And maybe some of the content that is there is really about or for that generation and some of the problems and struggles they were having. I think it is intriguing to read Genesis from that perspective. Okay? Not written at the time the events happened, written during the time of the Exodus, probably at a time where people really, really needed this. Did you want in on that?
Well, I was just going to say there is a theory, though, where you said that this is the account of Noah. This is the account of Jacob,
yes.
That there is a theory that some of those records had been kept by Adam and by Noah, and especially the generational information was kept. And it would have made sense that the Israelites would have had some records. And, you know, evolutionists like to say that people couldn't write or read, but early man was capable of a lot, and we believe that they could, you know, could read and write two things. So that's just a theory that I have understood people to say, and it makes sense with all the names and all of the generational information that they had.
Yeah.
Not the history, but the...
Yeah, either way, you have the Holy Spirit there. And the interesting thing, and we are, one of the things we will definitely talk about in class are the genealogies. I know, please don't drop out because of that. But the Spirit is doing some cool stuff with the genealogies in Genesis. And we're not going to blow by that too quickly because there's some really cool things that connect with the rest of the story that we need to stop and observe there. In fact, there's just a whole lot of stuff that's going on in this great book. I put in my wrap-up comments here some of the big thematic ideas that I think are at work in Genesis that we can play around with as we go through the class. The authority of God is one of those. I think that is one of the most important things that's laid out up front. It's something so, so needed today. So much so, we have a whole class going on down the hall, not to advertise for others, but nonetheless, Brian's teaching a great class down the hall that's talking about authority because that's such a struggle today. Genesis covers that. The character development that we've already alluded to, what we learn about God and what we learn about ourselves, about man, and what we learn about the adversary. Really, really, really important. So for class next Sunday night, 1 and 2, and as you read it, think about the creation story from the broader Bible story. What are we learning here that helps with the bigger story? We'll talk about that next week.